I want you to picture a woman walking down Wall Street.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
She's wearing a really sharp, impeccably tailored three-piece suit. She looks completely professional, completely in control of everything.
Right.
But there is one glaring, completely bizarre detail. She is walking around with a massive, heavy steel bank safe strapped directly to her back.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it looks like it weighs 1,000 pounds. She's sweating, she's moving really slowly, and there are like dozens of people following her around, constantly checking the locks on that safe.
That is quite the visual to start us off.
I want you to hold on to that image because that heavy steel safe is the absolute key to understanding, well, literally everything we're talking about today.
It really is.
But before we unlock that safe, pun intended, I need to mention something for anyone out there who is currently, banging their head against the wall studying for this exam.
Which is a very common feeling, by the way.
Totally. So, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 3 course, and it is just packed with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams.
And the best part is those exams are weighted exactly like the real test.
Right, so you aren't just guessing if you're ready, you actually know for sure. Check it out at certfuel.com. It's just an incredible resource.
It really is. And you're going to need a good resource because the Series 3 exam is definitely not something you can just, wing on a Saturday morning.
No, definitely not, especially the specific regulatory section we are unpacking today.
Oh, absolutely.
So today's mission is all about conquering the FCM and ID regulations unit. If you're looking at your syllabus, this is a massive chunk of part two of the Series 3 exam.
Right. And for this deep dive, we've pulled from the official National Futures Association, the NFA rulebook, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission regulations, and a bunch of different Series 3 study guides.
Yeah, and we're even going to look at some historical case studies of financial disasters just to explain why these rules actually exist in the real world.
And we really need to emphasize why you, the listener, should care about this specific stack of sources.
I mean, other than not wanting to fail.
Exactly. This regulation section makes up 29% of part two of your exam.
Wait, 29%? That is nearly a third of the material.
It is huge. But here is the critical part, and people mess this up all the time. Part two is graded as an entirely independent section.
Right.
You must score at least a 70% on part two alone just to pass the series three.
So you cannot get a perfect score on like the trading math in part one and use it to drag up a failing score on the regulations.
Absolutely not. There is zero hiding from this material. If you bomb the regulations, you fail the whole test.
Okay, high stakes. I know the word regulations usually makes people's eyes just completely glaze over. Like if you have ADHD like I do, your brain might be actively looking for a shiny object to distract you right now.
I get that. It can be incredibly dry material.
But stay with us. Memorizing a dry list of rules from a textbook is a terrible way to learn, and honestly, it's a terrible way to take a test.
It doesn't stick.
Exactly. We are going to make this weird today. We are going to make it memorable. You're going to look at the actual mechanisms behind the rule.
Right, because once you understand the underlying logic, like the actual why behind the regulation, you won't have to rely on just brute force memorization.
You'll just logically know the answer.
Exactly. And to do that, we need to establish a golden rule for this entire deep dive, the framework that dictates every single regulation we're going to discuss today.
Okay, lay it on me.
I call it the money test.
The money test. I like that. What is it?
It's one simple overarching question. Who is holding the customer's cash?
Who is holding the cash? Okay.
That's it. That is the physical reality that the entire regulatory framework of the futures industry is built around.
Yep.
If you get confused on a test question, like if you completely blank out under the fluorescent lights of the testing center, I want you to close your eyes, take a breath, and ask yourself, who is holding the bag of cash right now?
Because the person holding the cash carries all the risk, right?
Exactly. Holding someone else's money is the ultimate risk in finance.
Makes sense.
The government watchdog, the CFTC, and the industry's self-regulatory body, the NFA, they honestly don't care nearly as much about the people who just talk about trading.
Right, the salespeople.
Right. They care obsessively about the entity that actually takes physical possession of the customer's funds. The more of that money you hold, the heavier the regulatory burden placed on your shoulders.
Okay, so this brings me back to my woman walking down Wall Street with the giant safe strapped to her back.
Let's bring her back in.
To keep all this straight for the listener, we are going to create a cast of characters today. We are going to put names, faces, and like quirky personalities to these financial acronyms so they stop being alphabet soup.
Humanizing the concepts is honestly the best way to make abstract rules concrete. So, who is our woman with the safe?
First up, we have Fiona. Fiona is our FCM, our Futures Commission merchant.
Okay, Fiona the FCM.
Fiona means business. She wears that sharp three-piece suit. And she is the one walking around with the massive steel safe strapped to her back. That safe is filled with her customers' millions. She is holding the cash.
And because the FCM actually clears the trades and holds the customer funds in segregation, Fiona carries the absolute highest risk in this entire ecosystem.
Right, which is why she's sweating.
Exactly. Therefore, the regulators are watching her every single move.
Okay, next up, we have Ian. Ian is our independent IB, our independent introducing broker.
Ian the independent IB, got it.
Ian is a scrappy solo entrepreneur. He's got his sleeves rolled up. He's always hustling. He doesn't have a giant safe on his back, though.
No safe for Ian.
Instead, Ian walks around with a shiny silver metal briefcase handcuffed to his wrist. And inside that briefcase is exactly $45,000.
$45,000. Very specific number.
Very specific. And Ian likes to play the field. He dates around. You know, he isn't tied down to anyone in particular.
Well, he's independent.
Yeah.
He introduces accounts to the market, but he operates entirely on his own financial capital, that $45,000 in the briefcase you mentioned.
Right.
He answers only to himself, which gives him a lot of freedom, but it also leaves him without a safety net.
Then we have Gary. Gary is our guaranteed IB.
Oh, Gary.
Yeah, Gary is your classic, overly charismatic hype man. He wears a flashy suit. He talks a massive game. He's out on the golf course shaking hands all day.
The quintessential salesman.
Totally. But if you look closely at Gary, he has literally $0 in his wallet.
Not a dime.
Not a dime. A moth literally flies out when he opens it. And even more importantly, Gary is wearing a pair of heavy steel handcuffs, and he is handcuffed directly to Fiona's wrist.
Okay, that visual represents the guarantee agreement. Gary is entirely backed by Fiona. His business is literally an extension of hers.
And finally, we have Carl. Carl the customer.
Poor Carl.
Carl is just a regular guy. He's in a polo shirt, just trying to place a futures trade on some corn or crude oil without getting ripped off. He is handing over his hard-earned money and just trusting this whole complex system to actually work.
So just to recap the cash really quickly for the listener, Fiona the FCM holds the giant safe of customer cash.
Yep.
Ian the independent IB holds a briefcase with his own 45K and plays the field.
Right.
Gary the guaranteed IB has an empty wallet and is handcuffed to Fiona.
Exactly.
And Carl is just the customer trying to trade.
Keep those four people in your head. Now let's see them in action. Let's look at the fundamental difference between our introducing brokers, that's Ian and Gary, and our FCM, Fiona.
The core concept we need to define first is what an introducing broker actually does.
What's their day-to-day?
By definition, an IB solicits and accepts orders for the purchase or sale of a futures contract.
Yeah.
They are the frontline salespeople.
They're out on the golf course.
Exactly. They build the relationships, they talk strategy, they get the client on board. But here is the absolute non-negotiable rule.
Listen up.
An IB never holds customer money, customer securities, or customer property. Never.
Wait, let me make sure I'm getting this because I want to ask you a question. Let's say Carl, the customer, walks into Gary's office, right?
Okay.
He wants to open a trading account. He sits down, signs all the paperwork, and he writes a personal check for $10,000. Does Gary take that check?
I mean, Gary can physically touch an envelope if it's addressed to the FCM, but functionally, Gary never holds that money.
He can't deposit it.
No. The IB introduces the account, but Carl's money goes straight past the IB and directly into Fiona's steel safe. Fiona, the FCM, is the entity that formally accepts and holds the funds.
Let me try an analogy here to see if this tracks for the listener. Let's think of a massive car dealership out on the highway.
Okay, I can see it.
Gary and Ian are IBs. They are the salespeople walking around out on the hot asphalt. They shake your hand. They show you the legger seats in the new SUV. They convince you to buy it, and they get you to sign the preliminary order sheet.
Right.
But Gary and Ian don't personally own the cars on the lot, and they definitely don't take your down payment check and deposit it into their personal Wells Fargo accounts.
That's a perfect way to visualize it.
Hmm.
Fiona is the actual dealership building, like the corporate entity.
She owns the lot.
Exactly. She holds a title to the vehicles. Her finance department actually processes and holds your cash. And she is the one who officially clears the transaction and delivers the car to you.
So the salespeople on the lot, the IBs, never custody your cash. Their only job is to introduce you to the dealership?
Yes. That boundary is absolute.
Okay, that makes the boundary between an IB and an FCM crystal clear. The FCM takes the money. But as I was looking through the study materials, it seems like the exam is absolutely obsessed with the split between the two types of IBs,
Oh, they are.
like the guaranteed versus the independent. Why is that distinction so heavily tested?
Because it completely changes the regulatory and financial liability of the firm. It's arguably the most tested idea in this entire unit.
Seriously.
Yeah. Let's start by looking at Gary, our guaranteed IB, and unpack what those handcuffs actually mean in the real world.
Gary has the flashy suit and the empty wallet.
Right. The defining feature of Gary's business is the guarantee agreement. Gary has a written, legally binding guarantee agreement with exactly one FCM.
Just one.
Only one. In our scenario, he is handcuffed to Fiona.
What does that agreement actually do, though? Is it just like a marketing partnership?
Oh, it is much, much more severe than that. Because of this agreement, Fiona assumes strict liability for all obligations of Gary's futures business.
Wait, strict liability?
Yes, she is strictly liable for everything he does when dealing with customers.
Give me an example.
Well, if Gary makes a massive clerical error on an order ticket that costs a client 50 grand, Fiona has to make the client whole.
Oh.
If Gary gets caught making fraudulent claims to get people to trade, Fiona is on the hook for the regulatory fines and all the lawsuits. She has his back completely, whether she likes it or not in that moment.
Wow. So Fiona is taking on an immense amount of risk by putting those handcuffs on Gary. She's basically adopting him.
That's a good way to put it.
Which explains why Gary doesn't need his own safety net. If he messes up, Fiona pays. That's why his wallet is completely empty.
Precisely. Because he is backed by Fiona's massive capital reserves, the regulatory bodies say Gary has no minimum net capital requirement of his own.
Zero.
Right. We'll get into the exact numbers in a minute, but he is financially covered by his guarantor. However, the trade-off for that incredible financial backing is total exclusivity.
Exclusivity, meaning Gary cannot spread his customer accounts around.
Exactly.
So he can't go to another FCM if Fiona's clearing fees are, suddenly too high.
He cannot. He cannot shop for better deals, better margins, or faster execution at other FCMs. All of Gary's customers, without exception, must be introduced to and carried by Fiona. He is locked in.
Handcuffed. Okay, now let's look at Ian, the independent IB. Ian looks at Gary's handcuffs, looks at the exclusivity, and says, no thanks. I want my freedom. I want to play the field.
Right.
Ian does not sign a guarantee agreement with anyone. He stands completely alone.
And because Ian stands alone, without that massive safety net from an FCM like Fiona, the regulators look at him and ask a very practical question.
Would you?
They say, "All right, Ian, you're out here soliciting trades. If you make a mistake, or if your business operations hit a snag, who pays? You don't have Fiona's checkbook to fall back on."
So Ian basically has to prove he can pay for his own mistakes.
Yes. Ian has to rely on his own financial responsibility. The NFA requires him to maintain his own minimum net capital.
Yep.
He has to prove he has enough liquid cash on hand to keep his business running and absorb operational shocks.
That's the metal briefcase handcuffed to his wrist. He carries his own capital.
Exactly. But because Ian pays the price of independence by tying up his own capital, he gets a major reward in return freedom of choice.
He can date around.
He's free to shop around.
Yeah.
He can introduce his clients to one or more FCMs.
Oh, multiple XCMs.
Right. If one FCM has great rates for agricultural futures, he can send his farming clients there. If another has a great platform for financial futures, he can send his day traders there. He is not exclusive to anyone.
Let me jump in here. If I'm taking this exam, how are they going to try and trick me on this? Put me in the hot seat for a second.
Okay. They are going to try to mix and match the features of Gary and Ian to see if you are paying attention to the strict definitions.
Okay.
For example, a classic test question will present a scenario where a guaranteed IB decides to introduce customer accounts to several different FCMs in order to secure the best possible execution prices for his clients.
And they ask if it's allowed.
Yes,
Yes.
they will ask if this is permitted.
Oh, they try to make it sound noble. Like, oh, he's just trying to get the best prices for Carl.
Exactly.
But that's totally false. Gary is handcuffed to Fiona. Guaranteed means one guarantor. Exclusivity. If you, the listener, see the phrase several FCMs or multiple FCMs associated with an IB, that has to be an independent IB. You can't be guaranteed and play the field.
That is exactly right. Or they might flip it around on you. They might describe an IB that introduces accounts to multiple FCMs and then ask what their minimum net capital requirement is, hoping you'll think they are guaranteed and say zero.
Which brings us perfectly to the next major concept. We keep talking about this capital, the $45,000 in Ian's briefcase, the empty wallet for Gary, the giant safe for Fiona.
Let's get into the
Yeah,
numbers.
let's really drill down into the price of independence or what the regulators call the net capital requirements.
This is a foundational pillar of financial regulation. We need to clearly define adjusted net capital.
Okay.
The textbook definition is current assets minus liabilities minus certain charges against capital.
Okay, translating that from finance speak, it's basically an emergency fund, right?
Mostly, yes.
But it's more specific than that. It's the highly liquid cash cushion a firm has readily available to absorb losses so they don't go bankrupt and drag Carl's money down with them.
The word liquid is absolutely vital there. That is where the adjusted part comes in.
What do you mean?
Well, regulators don't care about assets that you can't quickly turn into cash during a crisis. If Ian owns a really nice, expensive mahogany desk for his office, that's an asset, technically.
Right.
But in a market crash, he can't pay his operational debts with a desk. So regulators subtract illiquid assets. They also apply what are called haircuts.
Haircuts. Like taking a little off the top.
Essentially, yes. If Ian holds some of his capital in, say, treasury bonds, the regulators recognize that the price of those bonds might fluctuate.
Sure.
If he has to sell them in an absolute panic, he might not get full price. So the regulators apply a percentage haircut. They discount the value of those securities when calculating his true safety net. They want to know the worst-case scenario, liquid cash value.
That makes a lot of sense. They want a really conservative estimate of the safety cushion. Now, the study materials heavily emphasize a specific phrase regarding this capital requirement, and it is at all times.
Yes.
Why is that so important?
Because it is the mechanism that keeps the entire industry solvent. The required minimum capital must be maintained at or above the threshold at all times.
At all times.
This is not a monthly check-in. It is not just for picture day on the last Friday of the quarter when the auditors ask for a screenshot of the bank account. It is a continuous living reality.
Okay, so let me throw a hypothetical at
Of
you.
course.
If Ian needs $45,000 and he has a really bad week and his capital dips to $40,000 on a random Tuesday at 2 p.m., but he instantly transfers money from his personal savings and gets it back up to $50,000 by 4 p.m., just a 2-hour gap, is he okay?
He is absolutely not okay.
Really?
That 2-hour window where he was below the minimum is a strict regulatory violation. An IB or FCM must immediately notify the regulators if they fall below the early warning requirements, let alone the actual minimum.
Immediate notification.
There are no temporary dips allowed.
I bet the test writers love to mess with people on that exact scenario. They'll probably give a question where a firm dips below the requirement for just one day, but fixes it before the official report is due, and ask if a violation occurred.
They absolutely will.
The answer is yes, a dip is a violation, period.
That is exactly how they test it. Now, let's lock in the three magic numbers you absolutely must have memorized for this exam.
Like your pen's out.
Let's start at the top of the food chain. Fiona, the FCM, how much adjusted net capital does she need?
Fiona requires $1 million. $1 million minimum.
Let's apply our golden rule. Why $1 million?
Because who is holding the cash? Fiona is. She has the giant steel safe. She is holding Carl's money. She is holding thousands of other customers' money. And she is the one guaranteeing all those trades to the central clearinghouse. If Fiona goes under, the whole system shutters. So maximum risk requires maximum cushion.
Precisely. The firm that custody the funds carries the heaviest burden. Now, what about Ian, our independent IB?
Ian needs $45,000. That is the exact amount inside his silver metal briefcase.
And again, let's look at the why. Ian doesn't hold customer money. Carl's 10 grand went straight to Fiona.
Right.
So Ian doesn't need a $1 million safety net. But Ian stands alone. He has no guarantee agreement.
He's flying solo.
If his rent goes up or he gets sued for a marketing violation, he needs his own safety net to stay solvent and keep servicing his clients. Therefore, the regulators decided on a modest cushion of $45,000.
I do want to add a quick footnote on Ian that I saw in the reading just in case. If Ian, the independent IB, happens to also be a registered securities broker-dealer, meaning he sells stocks and mutual funds on the side, he has to abide by the SEC's broker-dealer capital rules instead, assuming that number is higher.
That's a good caveat. The regulators always defer to the stricter requirement.
But if we are strictly talking about a futures ID on this exam, the magic number is 45K.
Correct. Finally, we have Gary the guaranteed IB. What is his minimum net capital requirement?
$0. Gary's wallet is completely empty except for that one moth.
Because of the guarantee agreement, Fiona has legally assumed all the risk. Therefore, the regulators do not require Gary to hold any capital of his own. His guarantor's capital covers him.
I want to paint a really absurd scenario to make these three numbers stick in the listener's brain forever.
I love a good absurd scenario.
Picture Fiona, Ian, and Gary all going out to a high-end steakhouse in Manhattan to celebrate a good quarter. They have a massive meal. Tomahawk steaks, lobsters, really expensive wine, the works. The waiter brings the check, it's a huge bill, and drops it right in the middle of the table. Let's see how they pay.
I'm listening.
Gary, our guaranteed IB, reaches into his flashy suit jacket. He pulls out his leather wallet, opens it up, and nothing is in there.
Nothing.
He just shrugs and looks across the table at Fiona. Legally, he isn't required to have a dime to his name. Fiona just sighs, reaches into her massive $1 million steel safe, pulls out a heavy, solid gold platinum corporate card, and swipes it to cover Gary's meal. She pays his bill because she guarantees him.
A perfect representation of strict liability.
Meanwhile, Ian, the independent IB, clicks open his metal briefcase right there on the white tablecloth. He doesn't have Fiona to help him out.
No, he doesn't.
So he just starts carefully, painstakingly counting out single dollar bills from his $45,000 stash until he hits his exact portion of the check. He's paying his own way.
It's a ridiculous image, but honestly, if a test question asks you about IB capital requirements, just think of the steakhouse.
Steakhouse.
Gary has zero, Ian has 45K, Fiona has a million.
So we know who holds the money, and we know how much emergency capital they have to keep. But here is the thing about government regulators.
They're paranoid.
Extremely. They don't just take your word for it. They don't just ask Ian, hey, buddy, you still got that 45K in the briefcase, and let him say, yep.
No, they certainly do not.
They want to see the receipts. Which brings us to the paperwork side of things, financial reports.
The core concept of financial reporting in the futures industry is that the cadence, how frequently you have to actually file the paperwork, directly mirrors the risk and the money the firm carries.
It follows the exact same logic as the capital requirement.
Exactly the same.
So the firms that are required to keep their own capital are the firms that have to file the reports to prove they actually have it. Let's break down the reporting schedule, starting with the heaviest burden. Fiona, our FCM.
Fiona holds the millions in customer funds. Therefore, the regulators are constantly checking in on her. Fiona must file unaudited financial reports on a monthly basis.
Every single month.
Every single month, she is submitting detailed financial snapshots to the CFTC and the NFA, proving her net capital is intact and customer funds are properly segregated.
Monthly. That's a ton of paperwork, but that's just the unaudited stuff. What about her big certified annual report, the one where an independent auditor comes in and scrubs everything?
This is where the exam gets very specific with deadlines.
Well,
Fiona must file her annual certified audited report within 60 days of her fiscal year end.
60 days. Okay, I want everyone listening to lock that number in. 60 days for Fiona.
Right.
Now, what about Ian, the independent IB? He's only holding his own $45,000, not customer money. Does he have to file every month too?
No, because his risk to the public is vastly lower. Ian gets a longer leash. Ian files his unaudited periodic report semi-annually, so twice a year, compared to Fiona's 12 times a year.
And his big annual audited report. How much time does he get for that?
Ian must file his audited report within 90 days of his fiscal year end. He gets an extra month compared to Fiona.
Okay, 90 days for Ian. And what about Gary, our guaranteed IB with the empty wallet? What does his reporting schedule look like?
Gary files nothing. Zero. He files no separate financial reports whatsoever.
And nothing. Not even once a year.
Not a single page.
You're kidding.
Nope. His guarantee agreement is his get out of paperwork free card. Because Fiona's massive complex reports legally encompass his entire operation, Gary doesn't have to hire an auditor or file standalone financials. Fiona's accountants handle it all.
I need to take a quick time out here because this genuinely makes me mad.
Why is that?
Because I have to do my own taxes every year. I have one single W-2 from my employer. It's a piece of paper with maybe three numbers on it.
Right.
And every April, it takes me an entire weekend of crying at my kitchen table, tearing my hair out, trying to navigate some terrible tax software, absolutely terrified I'm going to go to federal prison because I didn't understand line 14B on Schedule C.
The tax code is intimidating.
Intimidating. It's a nightmare. And then you have Gary. Gary gets to run around in a flashy suit, soliciting highly leveraged derivatives contracts in the futures market, dealing with commodities, And he doesn't have to file a single piece of financial paperwork.
It's a sweet deal for him.
It's outrageous. Gary is living the absolute dream.
It does seem a bit unequal when you frame it against personal taxes.
And meanwhile, poor Ian is sweating twice a year, and he gets exactly 90 days to hire an expensive independent auditor to certify his books.
Yep.
And Fiona, who has $1 million in capital and is holding hundreds of millions more of Carl's money in complex segregated accounts, gets the tightest deadline of all. Just 60 days to audit a massive institutional operation. The stress on Fiona must be unbelievable.
Your outrage is actually a fantastic memory tool for the listener.
Is it?
Yes. The NFA and the exam writers know that 60 days and 90 days are just abstract numbers floating in space. They're incredibly easy to mix up under the pressure of a time test.
Right. If you're staring at a multiple choice screen, 60 and 90 look very similar.
Exactly. So the exam will actively try to swap them. You will almost certainly see a question that says something like, an FCM must file its certified annual report within 90 days of its fiscal year end, and an independent IB must file within 60 days.
And the listener needs to immediately recognize that it's completely backwards.
Backwards.
Think about my rant at the kitchen table. Who has the hardest job? Fiona. She has the cash. She has the highest risk to the market. Therefore, the regulators are paranoid.
Right.
They want to see her audited numbers faster. They don't want to wait 3 months to find out if an FCM is insolvent. So Fiona gets the short, stressful deadline, 60 days.
Exactly.
Ian has less risk, no customer funds. So the regulators say, take your time, Ian. He gets 90 days.
Exactly. If you anchor everything back to the golden rule, who holds the money, you'll naturally remember that the firm holding the money always has the heavier burden. A heavier burden means more frequent reporting and shorter deadlines.
Still just so mad at Gary. Walking around with his handcuffs, no paperwork, no capital, zero stress. Must be nice.
Well, before your blood pressure spikes too high, let's pivot to the actual money that Carl is bringing to the table. Let's talk about the performance bond, more commonly known as margin deposits.
This is huge because we've established that Fiona the FCM holds the money. But what exactly is this money that Carl the customer is handing over?
Right.
When Carl decides he wants to buy one contract of December gold, he has to put up margin.
This is a critical conceptual hurdle for anyone taking the Series 3, especially if they have a background in trading stocks.
Why is that?
Because in the stock market, margin means something very specific. In the futures market, it means something entirely different. In futures, margin is a good faith performance bond. It is a security deposit guaranteeing that Carl will perform on his open positions.
Okay, let's define what it is not first, because I know from experience that if you bring stock market logic into a futures exam, you will fail.
Correct. Futures margin is not a partial payment toward buying the underlying commodity.
Explain that.
If Carl puts up $5,000 to trade a crude oil contract worth $80,000, he is not putting down a down payment to take physical delivery of a fraction of a barrel of oil.
It's not a down payment. Got it.
And perhaps more importantly, it is not a loan.
A loan.
Right. In the stock market, if you want to buy $10,000 of Apple stock but only have $5,000, the broker loans you the other $5,000 and you pay interest on it. You are financing the purchase.
That's how my Robinhood account works.
Exactly. True. In futures, you are not borrowing any money from Fiona to finance the rest of the position. You are just entering into a contract for future delivery. There is no loan, and therefore no interest charged on the remaining value of the contract.
Okay, I think I need an analogy here. Let's step away from finance for a second. Imagine Carl wants to throw a massive birthday party for his kid, and he decides to rent one of those giant commercial-grade bouncy castles.
Okay, let's see how this maps to the futures market.
Carl goes to the rental company, and the guy says, okay, Carl, the rental is yours for Saturday, but before you take this massive piece of equipment, I need a $500 security deposit.
Right.
When Carl hands over that $500, he isn't buying one-tenth of the bouncy castle. It's not a partial payment towards ownership.
Correct. He doesn't own a piece of it.
And he isn't taking out a mortgage from the rental guy to finance the bouncy castle. It's not a loan.
Right again.
What he is doing is putting down a deposit to prove he has skin in the game.
Skin in the game.
He's proving to the rental company that he is going to make sure the kids take the shoes off, that nobody brings in sharp objects, and that he isn't going to pop the bouncy castle. Because if he pops it, the rental guy keeps the deposit to cover the damage.
That is a brilliant analogy. That is exactly the mechanism of futures margin.
Mm-hmm.
It is a deposit sitting in an account to cover potential damage.
Right.
In the financial world, The damage is an adverse market movement that goes against Carl's position.
Like if the price dropped.
Yes. If Carl buys gold and the price of gold plummets, Carl is losing money. The margin deposit is there to ensure that when it comes time to settle the account at the end of the day, Carl actually has the cash to cover his losses. It protects the FCM and, by extension, the entire market.
Okay, so if margin is just a security deposit for a bouncy castle, who actually collects it?
We apply the golden rule again. Only the firm that legally holds customer funds can collect margin.
Fiona.
That means Fiona, the FCM, collects the initial margin from Carl before or promptly after a new position is opened. If the market goes against Carl and his deposit shrinks too much, Fiona is the one who issues a maintenance margin call, asking him to top up the deposit.
And what do Gary and Ian do in this process?
They do absolutely nothing regarding the collection of margin.
Nothing.
The IB's role stops at taking the order and making sure the account paperwork is signed. They do not issue margin calls, and they certainly don't collect the checks.
Now, I saw something in the study guides about segregation. Fiona doesn't just put Carl's margin deposit into her own checking account, right?
Absolutely not. That is one of those sacred rules in futures regulation. Customer funds must be held in segregated accounts.
Segregated accounts?
Yes. Fiona cannot mix Carl's margin money with her firm's operational money. If Fiona wants to buy a new office building or pay out bonuses, she cannot dip into the segregated customer funds to do it.
And history tells us that when FCMs violate this rule, it ends in total disaster.
Oh, yes. The classic catastrophic example is MF Global back in 2011.
Oh, man.
John Corsine was running the firm. They made massive, disastrous bets on European sovereign debt. As the firm was collapsing and running out of cash, they improperly transferred hundreds of millions of dollars out of segregated customer accounts to cover the firm's overdrafts.
They literally raided Carl's safe.
They did. And when the music stopped, over $1 billion of customer money was missing. Yes. It was eventually recovered after years of litigation, but it completely destroyed trust in the system. That is why the NFA and CFTC audit Fiona so heavily and why that 60-day deadline exists. They are verifying that the segregated funds are untouched.
That brings real gravity to the rules. So if I'm looking at a test question about margin, how will they try to trip me up?
They will exploit your preconceived notions about the stock market. You might see a question asking for the definition of futures margin, and one of the multiple choice options will describe it as borrowing funds to establish a leverage position or financing a portion of the purchase price.
Mm-hmm. The moment the listener sees the words borrowing, financing, or loan in a question about futures margin, they need to cross it out immediately.
It is a trap.
It is a total trap. Remember the bouncy castle? It's a deposit. It's a good faith performance bond.
Spot on. So Carl has put up his initial margin. It's sitting securely in Fiona's segregated vault.
Yeah.
Carl is officially ready to trade.
Okay, Carl is ready.
He picks up the phone and calls his broker, Gary, to place an order.
Which brings us to the actual mechanics of trading, and specifically the ticking clock, the time stamping requirements.
The audit trail.
Here is the scenario. Carl calls Gary at his office and says, Gary, buy me 100 contracts of December gold at the market price. Gary says, you got it, Carl, and hangs up the phone.
Okay.
Now, how do the regulators know that Gary didn't hear that massive order, realize that much volume might cause gold to spike slightly, and use Carl's idea to quickly buy 10 contracts for himself first before putting Carl's order into the system?
That illegal practice is called front running.
Front running.
It's stealing a customer's market impact for your own profit. And the regulatory defense against front running is the audit trail. The regulators demand to know exactly when an order was received and exactly when it went to the market down to the minute.
The ticking clock. Every second matters.
The core concept you must memorize here is that every single customer order gets exactly 2 timestamps.
Not one, 2. Walk us through the journey of that order ticket.
Stamp number 1 happens upon receipt. The exact moment Gary receives that order from Carl, whether Carl called on the phone, sent an email, or walked into the office. Gary must immediately prepare a written record of the order and timestamp it with the date and time of receipt to the nearest minute.
Immediately. He doesn't wait until the end of the day when he's wrapping up his paperwork and try to guess when Carl called.
Exactly. It must be contemporaneous. Then, stamp number 2 happens upon execution.
That's the second one.
The order ticket is stamped a second time to record the date and time it is transmitted to the exchange for execution or when it is reported as filled.
Why do we need 2 stamps? If we know when it was executed, isn't that enough?
No, because these 2 stamps bracket the life of the order. They create a verifiable, auditable timeline.
How sad.
If an auditor comes in and looks at Gary's tickets and sees a receipt stamp at 10 a.m., but an execution stamp at 10:45 a.m., they're going to ask Gary some very hard questions.
Like what?
Like, what were you doing with Carl's order for 45 minutes? Were you delaying it? Were you reordering your stack of tickets to disadvantage Carl and help someone else? Or trade for your own account? The two stamps prove a clean sequence of events.
Okay, let's use another analogy. Let's say I'm starving and I order a pizza from Gary's Pizzeria.
Always back to Gary.
The delivery guy finally shows up at my house and the box has a big red stamp on it that says delivered at 8 p.m.
Okay.
That's one stamp, but I'm furious because I feel like I've been waiting forever. If that delivery stamp is the only information I have, how do I know if the pizza place was just incredibly fast and I actually ordered at 7:45 p.m.
Right.
Or if the delivery guy put my pizza in his car at 6 p.m. and drove around for 2 hours running personal errands before finally dropping it off.
You don't know.
Mm.
You lack the starting point of the timeline.
Exactly. I need the ordered at 7:30 p.m. stamp on the receipt plus the tump delivered at 8 p.m. stamp on the box.
The brackets.
Those two stamps bracket the delivery time. It proves the delivery guy only took 30 minutes. He couldn't have been holding my pizza hostage for 2 hours.
That is exactly how the audit trail works in futures. You need the received stamp and the executed stamp.
Here's the stamps.
And by the way, it's not just about stamping them and throwing them away. These order records, along with all the other required books and records of the firm, must be kept for 5 years.
5 years?
Yes. And for the first 2 years, they must be kept readily accessible in the firm's main office.
5 years. Regulators really love a paper trail. So let's play the game. If I'm taking the exam, how do they test this?
The exam will offer a multiple choice option trying to simplify the rule. It'll say something like, a customer order only needs to be timestamped when it is executed at the exchange. Or timestamping is only required upon receipt of the order from the customer.
Wrong on both counts. Two stamps. Okay. Always. On receipt and on execution. If an answer choice only gives you one stamp, it's garbage. Throw it out.
All right. We are moving into the final stretch here. We need to cover how these firms interact with the public. This involves promotional material, disclosure of costs, and how to handle customer complaints.
Let's assume Gary got Carl to open an account in the first place by using some slick marketing materials. What are the rules for how Gary is allowed to talk to the public?
The NFA has a very broad, very simple core rule for all promotional material. Do not mislead the public.
Straightforward.
Communications cannot be deceptive. They cannot employ high-pressure sales tactics, and they cannot contain material misstatements or omit important facts.
Basically, don't lie, don't trick people, and don't tell them trading futures is a guaranteed path to wealth.
Right. And a massive area of focus for regulators is the presentation of past performance.
Okay, let's talk about that.
If Gary shows Carl a chart of how his trading strategy performed over the last year, it must be accurate and balanced. He cannot cherry-pick only his winning accounts and ignore the losers to make his strategy look better than it actually is. Selective presentation is highly illegal.
What if Gary has a brand new strategy? He's a smart guy, he built an algorithm, and he ran a computer simulation over the last 10 years of market data.
Backtesting.
Right. On paper, it looks like a gold mine.
This is called hypothetical performance, right?
Yes, and hypothetical results are heavily, heavily regulated because, as they say, hindsight is 20/20.
Of course it is.
When you backtest a strategy on historical data, you already know exactly how the market moved. It is incredibly easy to over-optimize a strategy, to tweak the rules so that it perfectly predicts a market crash after the crash has already happened. The CFTC knows that paper trading always looks better than real trading.
So if Gary wants to use these hypothetical paper trading results in his brochure, what does he have to do?
He absolutely must include the prescribed cautionary disclaimer.
The big warning label. This is a very specific, bold, unavoidable warning mandated by the CFTC that tells the prospect, hey, these results have inherent limitations because they were prepared with the benefit of hindsight. They don't represent real money. And there are a million psychological factors in real trading that aren't accounted for here.
It's like a reality check.
Furthermore, Gary must be able to demonstrate to the regulators the exact mathematical basis for how he calculated those results if they audit him. He can't just make up numbers.
Okay, what about testimonials? Let's say Gary gets his cousin to write a glowing review for his website saying, Gary's a genius. He doubled my money in 2 weeks.
Testimonials are another minefield. They have three strict rules. First, they must be representative of what customers generally experience.
No outliers.
Right. You cannot use an extreme lottery ticket outlier to imply that everyone gets that result. Second, the testimonial must explicitly state that past performance does not guarantee future results.
We've all heard that disclaimer a million times in commercials.
Exactly. And third, Gary must prominently disclose if the person giving the testimonial was paid or compensated in any way.
Like, I paid my cousin $100 to say this, gotta be honest. And one more thing on promotional material supervisory review. Gary can't just print these brochures in his basement and start handing them out at the grocery store, can he?
No, definitely not. A designated supervisory person at the firm, someone qualified, must review and approve all promotional material before it is ever used.
Before?
Yes, before. They also have to keep records of the material and the approval for that 5-year period we talked about.
Okay, let's talk about costs. Because trading isn't free, there are commissions, exchange fees, NFA fees.
The rule for disclosure of transaction costs is fascinating because it is entirely about transparency, not price control. Firms must disclose all costs honestly to the customer upfront.
I found this really interesting when we were prepping for this. Regulators in the U.S. don't actually care how much you charge?
No, they don't.
A firm can legally charge outrageous sky-high fees if they want to. There is no federally mandated fee cap that says you can only charge $5 a trade.
That's right. The NFA doesn't dictate pricing. The free market does. The violation isn't charging a high fee. The violation is deceiving the customer about the true cost.
Deception is the crime.
Exactly. Gary can charge Carl $100 a trade if he wants, but he cannot hide that fact in fine print or bury it in a confusing fee structure so that Carl doesn't realize it until his account equity is drained.
Honesty over affordability. Capitalism at its finest. Okay, let's say Gary did charge Carl $100 a trade and Carl just realized it.
Oh boy.
Carl is furious. He picks up the phone and calls Gary, absolutely screaming at the top of his lungs. He wants to complain. Let's look at the life cycle of a customer complaint.
The overarching unbreakable rule is that firms must keep a written record of every single customer complaint.
Let me throw a scenario at you and let's see if the listener can guess the answer. Carl calls Gary. He is yelling, he is cursing, he is furious about the fees. Gary is trying to follow the rules, so he says, "Carl, please calm down and put this in an email so I can officially log your complaint."
Sounds reasonable.
But Carl screams, "No, I'm not writing an email. I'm telling you right now, on the phone, I demand a refund." Does Gary have to record this complaint? Think about it for a second.
The answer is an absolute yes. Oral complaints count just as much as written ones.
This is a massive point. A firm cannot ignore a verbal complaint just because the customer refuses to put it in writing.
Exactly. Historically, shady brokers used to use the excuse, well, they never sent a letter, so it wasn't an official complaint, to hide their misdeeds.
Clever, but illegal.
The regulators shut that down. It is the firm's duty to reduce that oral complaint to a written record and log it in their complaint file. The burden is on the professional, not the customer.
Customer Carl yelled at me regarding fees at 3 p.m., logged.
Exactly.
Now, Gary is at a branch office, or maybe he's just acting as our guaranteed IB. Does he just log that complaint and leave it in his own desk drawer?
No. Complaints received at a branch office or by a guaranteed IB must be immediately forwarded to the main office, or to the guarantor FCMSO, in our cast, to Fiona.
Right.
And the resolution of that complaint must be supervised and reviewed by someone with authority.
Fiona needs to know if Gary is making people scream on the phone, because remember, she is strictly liable for him.
Yes, she is.
Now, what if Carl was trading options on futures? Does that change the complaint process?
Not at all. Options complaints run through the exact same process. There are no special shortcuts. They're recorded, forwarded, and supervised, just like a standard futures complaint.
And finally, let's say Gary investigates the complaint and realizes he actually did mess up. He accidentally double-charged Carl on a trade ticket. He needs to do an account adjustment to fix it.
The account adjustments must be fair to the customer and heavily documented. The rule here is simple. You can never use an account adjustment to quietly hide a firm error, favor the firm over the customer, or deceive the customer about what happened.
No sweeping it under the rug.
Exactly. If you made a mistake, you document it clearly, you fix it fairly, and you leave an audit trail. You don't just quietly move money around to make the balance sheet look right and hope nobody notices.
Okay, let's flag the exam traps to close out this section. How will they try to trick the listener on complaints and marketing?
The exam will give you all sorts of reasonable sounding carve-outs. They will say oral complaints do not need to be recorded unless the customer subsequently provides written notice.
And that is false.
They will say Options complaints follow a specialized, separate NFA dispute resolution process.
False. Same process.
They will say promotional material only needs to be reviewed by a supervisor after a customer files a complaint about it.
False. It must be reviewed before first use.
Document every complaint. Review everything beforehand. No exceptions.
Wow. Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. We went really deep into the mechanics of these rules. We are at the end of the line, and it is time for our rapid-fire recap.
All right, let's do it.
I'm going to throw out a concept we covered, and I want you, the listener, to recall the answer before the expert says it. Ready?
I'm ready.
Number one, the golden rule, the money test. Who is the only entity that actually touches and holds customer money? Wait for it.
Only the FCM Fiona with the safe.
Number two, minimum adjusted net capital. What is the requirement for a guaranteed IB? Think of Gary's wallet at the steakhouse. Think about it.
$0. His guarantor covers it.
What is the capital requirement for an independent IB? Think of Ian's metal briefcase.
$45,000.
And the FCM?
$1 million.
Yes. Okay. Deadlines for the annual certified audited financial report. How many days does the FCM get? Remember, who has the most risk?
60 days.
How many days does the independent IB get?
90 days.
Is futures margin a loan to help you finance the purchase of a commodity?
No. It is a good faith performance bond. Think of the bouncy castle deposit.
The ticking clock. How many timestamps does a customer order ticket require?
Two. One on receipt and one on execution.
And finally, do oral customer complaints count as official complaints?
Yes. The firm must reduce them to writing and log them.
Nailed it. If you can understand the logic behind those answers, you are going to absolutely crush this 29% of the Series 3 exam.
Before we sign off, I want to leave you with a final, broader thought to chew on.
Okay, what is it?
We've spent this entire deep dive looking at a regulatory framework that is completely anchored to a physical reality, which is the risk of holding a bag of cash.
Right. The money test.
Fiona holds the money, so Fiona bears the heavy regulation. But look at where the mechanics of finance are heading right now. We're moving toward a world of smart contracts, instantaneous settlement, and decentralized ledgers, where funds are held in escrow by code, not by a firm in a suit.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. I hadn't actually thought about that.
Ask yourself this. If technology eventually eliminates the risk of a broker absconding with customer cash-like, if the counterparty risk is perfectly managed by an immutable blockchain instead of Fiona's steel safe, does this entire regulatory framework become obsolete?
That is a wild thought.
Do we even need a $1 million capital requirement if the money literally can't be stolen? Or do the regulators just find new ways to define who is holding the digital key?
They'll definitely find a way to regulate it.
Probably.
Yeah.
It's just something to think about as you study for an exam built on today's rules, knowing that tomorrow's market might look very, very different.
That is a wild thought to end on. Imagine Gary, the guaranteed IB, trying to explain a smart contract to Carl. Well, until that decentralized utopian future arrives, you still have to pass this test.
You do.
So remember Fiona's heavy safe, remember Ian's metal briefcase, remember Gary's empty wallet, and remember to check out certfuel.com if you want to make studying a breeze. You've got this. Keep grinding, keep reviewing, and we will see you on the next deep dive.